The Boulder Tech Podcast is presented by Boulder Startup Week 2019 title sponsor, Techstars. At the core, Techstars is a company founded by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs. With more than 300,000 alumni and 10,000 mentors across 150 countries, Techstars is a worldwide network that helps entrepreneurs succeed. To learn more, go to techstars.com. Welcome to the Boulder Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Davis. This is one of 20 interviews recorded in a pop-up backroom studio at Dojo 4 during the 10th annual Boulder Startup Week. When it started in 2009, Boulder Startup Week was the first event of its kind anywhere. Now, Startup Weeks are held around the world. It's a great example of Boulder's position on the leading edge of tech and the future. Our guest for episode 39 is Susan Krause, CEO of TraxArt Toys, a company founded to get kids back on the ground and playing with toys. Among many things, Susan and I chat about what drew a longtime high-end product development manager to toys, why being a product developer is great prep for becoming a CEO, Susan's strong advocacy for rapid prototyping, and the cruel irony underlying the fundraising challenges faced by women in tech. All of that and more as the Boulder Tech Podcast speaks with TraxArt Toys' Susan Krause. Susan, you've been the CEO of TraxArt Toys for 3 years now, but have a long history of working in product development in a number of areas. What drew you to toys?
I've been interested in Spiro, who's a Boulder company, for a number of years. I saw their first Spiro Ball robotic toy right before it was released to the public. And a few years ago, I went to CES, and they had Spiro on this big table, and they were rolling it around, and I'm looking at it thinking, well, what do kids do with this after a while? You know, it just doesn't have a much engagement. And I know they're doing great things with programming and teaching kids how to program, but the everyday kid at home, it kind of ends up at the bottom of their toy box eventually. So I told Spiro a long time ago, I'm gonna do something with your toy someday, and I just had this kind of epiphany right there that, oh, we need to build some kind of really dynamic environment that kids can design and use their hands and create mazes and games for these robotic toys so it gives them more purpose. I think, you know, we know Enki just went out of business a couple weeks ago. A lot of it, I think, is that kids just don't know what to do with these toys once they get them.
And how does developing a toy differ from developing a product for, say, a power company?
Yeah, it's interesting. My background is in really high-tech, big-tech racks of equipment. And here I'm doing something that's reasonably simple. It's the mat, it has walls and pegs, and you interconnect them to make tunnels and things. And we decided to add some tech into it and put some sensors in it. But really, I tell a lot of people that are early in their career, if you want to go out and be a product manager, that will be the best career you can do to prepare you to be a CEO of a startup. And I'm really doing this out of passion. I just had this idea that I thought was a great idea, and let's just go do it. I'm kind of an inventor at heart. I have about three other ideas waiting on my shoulders till this one kind of launches off and gets going. It doesn't really matter, right? This execution is the same. You have to have an idea. You have to specify it. You have to iterate. You have to talk with customers. You have to train your sales team. You have to work with the manufacturer. You have to work with the engineers. And that's what CEOs do. It's what product managers do. So it was a good training ground for me.
And how did you get into product development in the first place? Were you always sort of even as a kid, a hands-on tinkering kind of person, or?
It's funny. When I go on interviews for jobs, I tell people I have a very split brain. I'm very equally right brain and left brain. So in my spare time, I'm actually an artist, and I've been an artist for many years. And I started out my career, actually, my first job was as a computer animator. It's one of my silly claim to fame. I'm probably one of the first computer animators on the planet. And I worked on a very cool system called Scanimate that was developed here in Colorado. And it was a bunch of racks, and it had a patch bay on it where you put little wires in the patch bay. And what you did was bend the TV raster into spheres or star fields or things like that. And we did commercials for American Furniture Warehouse and banks and people like that. And it was really awesome. It was really fun. And I went from there to work for a company that developed the first real-time animation system. So that's kind of how I got my start. So yes, I've always kind of mixed art and technology together.
And that's something that interests me. It's something that has come up in a couple of other conversations this week, is that crossroads of art and technology, because they seem sort of oppositional in some ways, but I definitely see where they can come together. And so I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that. Are you an artist first or a technologist first, or how would you describe that balance?
That's a really hard question for me. I mean, the art part of my life is something that's really important to me. Like, I can tell when I haven't done something. I haven't been in my studio a lot the last 6 months because of this startup, but I'm also building a house at the same time, and a custom home, and I've been doing a lot of the art in that home. But if I'm not engaged in the technical community, that's why I do the Boulder New Tech and I go to Boulder Open Copy Club. If I'm not engaged with people talking about the future and invention, I'm not happy either. So it's really a life balance for me to have both a good weight of the creative and a good weight of the analytic kind of technology side too.
And would you say that you could approach technology through an artist lens?
So I have a really good example of that. In this house I'm building right now, I saw a sink online that was like a Nautilus sink, and I finally found it in Europe, and it was $5,000 and probably $2,000 to ship it. And I'm like, well, I still really want this sink. So I hadn't done 3D animation in a while, but I have lots of friends that still do it. I'm like, hey, could you model this for me? So I had somebody model me a Nautilus, and then I found a 3D printer that would print that Nautilus for me. Then I found a concrete guy here in Boulder, Concrete Pete, who molded it for me. And every step along the way was a struggle, just like a startup, like getting the model just right, getting the right 3D printer at the right price, because it was going to be super expensive, but I found a guy that would do it at a reasonable price. And then when we actually popped the concrete off the model, knowing whether it was really going to release from this ABS model, I don't know if anyone's ever done it before. So it was this great exploration of creativity mixed with technology. And we actually left all the artifacts of the 3D print on the Nautilus, so it's a kind of like an archaeology of 3D printing in the sink itself. It looks really cool. So, you know, that's just kind of me. That's how I run. Same thing with my doors too. I went and found somebody so I could design custom doors. So I'm like, oh, it's a CNC machine. How does that work? What does it do? And what could I possibly do? And I just dive in and figure it out.
Personally, I love to have that artistic touch, even if it's on to something technological, just to have that personal human touch on it.
Artist friends that I have are like, they aren't that keen in using like an iPad to draw or whatever. Some of them are coming around to that. And I kind of just tell people, you're still the vessel. You're still the one that's coming up with the ideas and the art and the way you want to do it. This is just another tool. An electronic pen versus a paintbrush is just another tool that's in your box of things you can use to create art.
Right. It's like you could write a book on paper. You could write the same words to the computer. It doesn't take away from the underlying artistry, the essence of the book, and it's probably a lot easier to use and do on the computer, but maybe a little more fun to write.
Less toxic, maybe, if you're an artist too.
So I want to get back to toys a little bit. I am not a parent, but I am an uncle, and I was just talking with an office mate about this earlier this morning. It was probably 12 or so years ago now. My nephew is turning 4 or 5, and my wife and I went to the toy store to get him something, and it had probably been the first time I've been in a toy store since I was a kid, and things had changed quite a bit. I remember when I was, you know, 6 years old or something, getting just a box, a cubic foot cardboard box full of just Lego pieces. It wasn't the police station or the space shuttle or anything like that. It was just Lego. And it was amazing to me that you couldn't just get that it was always some sort of set of like, here's the plan to make this thing. And I was also looking for a squirt gun for a river trip, and you couldn't just get a plastic squirt gun. They all had sounds and lights, and you needed batteries for them. And I just thought that was ridiculous. And it seemed like that was the case with pretty much all the toys, that there wasn't something that you could just kind of like have basically essentially like a lump of clay and your imagination and just play with it. My office mate called it raw toys. It's hard to get a raw toy anymore. And so I'm wondering, I'm just curious about your thoughts on that. Are toys today, with all the sounds and lights that they come with, does that somehow detract from the experience, or maybe not detract from the experience, but take away from the child's use of their imagination with that toy?
So I'm going to answer this, not really the question that you asked exactly, because one thing that's really great about Kinesium, the toy that we've developed, is it's a lot like Legos. And they like to call it in the toy industry an evergreen toy. So you could get a toy at Christmas, play with it for a couple of weeks, and it gets broken, and it, you know, and parents that don't expect a lot of them to even last, right? But our concept is we're taking kids that are learning how to program these robotic toys. They're doing that analytic stuff, building and programming. But then we want them to use the right side of their brain with Kinesium. So it's really cool when we take it, particularly into a classroom or even at a festival where kids don't know each other and they're on the same mat trying to develop a maze, and how quickly figure out how to use the pegs and build the walls. You know, I might have a little sample of something on the mat, but sometimes I'm talking to the parent and I'll turn around and literally every time we take this somewhere, some kid figures out how to do something with these three simple pieces that I've never done before. Last week it happened. I was like, oh, duh, I should have figured that out a long time ago. And just the way they engage with it, all the pieces are flexible so they can make curved shapes, they can make hoops and jumps, and they can build up high, they can make skee ball and croquet. And the idea is that they're going to be able to take technology eventually and integrate completely with the toy. So we have a couple sensors they can stick in the toy, and we want the kids to be inventors with this toy. So the idea is they start off with a clean slate, like a canvas, and they create some kind of game. It could be anything from a sports game to just a maze or a Rube Goldberg machine. And then they have to figure out how those sensors are going to work. And then they actually might go back to an app and say, okay, my first sensor is going to score 10 points. My second sensor is going to subtract points, or whatever it is that they come up with. And potentially we're going to interact directly with the robot. So we're working with Sphero, and we'd like if you run into the sensor, it shuts Sphero off and it ends the game, right? You're supposed to avoid the sensor, kind of like the tippy games where you try to keep the ball out of the hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I like the fact that it's taking something technological that they're learning in robotics and something very creative where they get to be very design oriented and collaborate and work together and get the same thing I talked about before, the full use of their right brain and their left brain experience.
And I really appreciate that, because I have to confess, when I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking, oh, great, a toy. It's going to be just a thing where it provides the sound and it provides the lights and you don't have to use your imagination with it. And then I watched the video for Kinesium and it was like, oh, this is really cool. I see that there's a robot, and what kid isn't going to love robots? I mean, even before there were robots, I was fascinated by them. But the part where you could basically create your own course for the robot to run on the Kinesium, and I saw that it was really just, like you said, a blank slate, and it's up to the kids to figure out how to set that up. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, the teachers really like it. I mean, I think the teachers see, well, our motto is play more on the floor. I think the teachers really love the hands-on stuff. Like kids that are in tech, sometimes they get good dexterity because they're playing video games, but if they don't, like just picking up the pegs, the feel of the walls, putting them together, it's just a really nice feeling to make things, right? It makes them makers.
And do you think that there's something, clearly it seems like there is, because as you said, the kids just sort of, you put it in front of them and they figured out how to do it. And so there's some sort of innate sense of that hands-on thing. And that's something that I feel gets lost a lot in our technological digital age, is just the analog and having that hands-on sort of experience. So
I think Legos have tended to be a little bit more boy-centric. So they made pink Legos for a while. And then they started doing these kits, which I actually didn't really like, because then you make it and then what do you do with it, right?
Right.
But one thing we've really discovered too is girls interact slightly differently, but they get right in and love it too. You know, I constantly hear, oh, my kids love construction stuff. Mm-hmm. And they can't get them to leave the toy when we're at a trade show. I had a mom literally with a phone saying, 2 minutes, 1 minute, look at the phone, you have 30 seconds to right. Get out of here. We got to go on. We got to go do something else. So I love to see how engaged their brains are, and they're learning math and physics intrinsically. Mm-hmm. Like they'll build something, they'll try to get their robot to go up a ramp that physics will not allow it to go up, and they'll look at it and go, oh, I guess, you know, I don't have to tell them. They go, oh, that's too hard, and they lower the ramp down for the robot. So they're learning physics in kind of an interactive way.
Speaking of hands-on sort of things, I see that you're a proponent of rapid prototyping to get products off the ground. Talk a little bit about the origins of that and your approach to it. It sounds like a lot of fun.
So I did a panel yesterday on rapid prototyping. We had a blast. Just on the origin of our company a little bit, I started the company and invited my son, who I have the pleasure of working with, and a few of his friends over and said, hey, I have this idea for this toy. Would you guys like to work on it? And I was thinking maybe two of them would say yes. They're busy people. They have jobs, right? And all four of them said yes. And I'm like, well, this isn't the way you should start a company, but I'm going to say yes to all of them because it'll be a great experience for all of them. They may not all stick with it. Let's just go for it. And literally the next day we went up to a classroom at CU and we went to the hardware store before we got there into Hobby Lobby. And we just picked up materials that we thought were kind of on the path. You know, I'd drawn a few things saying, this is kind of my idea, but we have a long way to go. So we picked up dowels and we picked up linoleum floor strips and plastic strips and foam core board. And we just started putting things together. And Google kind of was a good proponent of this rapid prototyping with their glasses, the Google glasses. They actually have a whole class they teach on how to do this, and one of our founders had actually been through that class. But the great part was is we could iterate. We really took that very early prototype. I think we had the foam mats for the first prototype for our beta kids, but we didn't have anything else. We still had the dowels, and we iterated with them, watched what they did a lot of videotaping, went back, did a little bit more work, iterated, took it back to them, took it to a trade show behind a curtain, iterated some more. So it was just, it went pretty quickly. I mean, it's a reasonably simple system, but the peg itself is reasonably complex, and it took us a few iterations to get to that. But 3D printing, of course, really helped along the way. But we had a pretty snazzy looking prototype by the fall, you know, within 6 months, that we could take to companies and take to trade shows and test a lot. And then last year we went and built 5 more by hand. So, you know, it's tricky, but it's worked really well. And with the tools of today and all the maker spaces that are out there, we're working with a company called SolderWorks in Westminster. They're a shared space for makers. They have an electronics room, they have a 3D print room, they have a cutting room with a small CNC machine, and they actually sponsor companies. So they let you come in and use all their tools and work there for 6 months to kind of get you off the ground. And that was invaluable to us during all of this process.
I see that you are launching a Kickstarter campaign later this week.
We are. I'm crazy to be here talking to you this morning. I kind of pushed back on Kickstarter for a long time, but at some point I was like, you know, I think if you really understand how Kickstarter works and realize that whatever you raise is not going to be enough money to do what you want to do, and know that going in, I mean, don't go in thinking I'm going to raise enough money to launch this company, because that usually isn't what happens, because it costs money to make money. But we got really lucky. We're launching on Friday at Maker Faire in San Francisco. So we're going out to this big Maker Faire, and we've been talking to Spiro pretty much from day one, and we went back there a couple weeks ago and they said, yeah, we'd be happy to partner with you and put Spiros in your kits. We also have been talking to a company called Wowie, so they're putting their MIP robot in one of our kits, and that solves kind of a marketing conundrum for us a little bit, that, you know, you want to have a robotic toy to have one of these kits, so we wanted people to be able to get the robot during the Kickstarter with the toy if they didn't already have a robotic toy. Our research says there's about 10 million robotic toys already out there, so for us, we're really lucky because we can just go after the people that we already know have that. We don't have to really figure out our market. It's really very obvious.
Right.
And then, you know, tons of schools have Spiros and robots and Cosmos and other robots for robotics programs, and they really love Kinesium. So we have this very targeted market we're trying to approach. So with Spiro launching a Kickstarter a couple months ago with their rover car, they're going to kind of help us through getting this stage. And, you know, we have our fingers crossed. We hope that we get great adoption and things go really well.
How long will the campaign run?
It's a month, so it'll be over on June 16th.
And so this is a campaign to bring Kinesium to market.
Yeah, so we actually have already been getting prototypes back from China, and they've been beautiful. They've been really good luck with everything so far. I've worked in Asia for really big products, but not for toys. It's a completely different world. And I had to kind of go figure that out on our own. We had prototyped our sensor with one of our mechanical engineers who's never done electronics. And we bumped into Jim Atwell and Isaac Davenport, both former Spiro employees. And they were building a sensor for stuff they're working on that was exactly what we wanted. And it was already done. It's already ready to go into manufacturing. They've already set up the manufacturing line in China. So that's the hardest thing we had to do. And then the mats and the walls, we've already gotten samples back. So pretty much we just have to do the plastic injection molds for a couple of the plastic pieces that we're going to do. So we're ready to manufacture. So once the Kickstarter's over, we're just going to start driving that manufacturing, because it's really important to us to deliver these before Christmas. So we feel very good that we'll be able to deliver between October and November this year for the people that sponsor us on Kickstarter.
So it sounds like things are kind of lining up for you and coming together all at the right time.
Hope so.
Kinesium is TraxArt's first and still only toy?
Yeah, I mean, we will see what happens. The cool thing about Kinesium is, like I said, it's evergreen. We already have lots of ideas about expanding it, so we can add expansion packs for people, extra sensors, or you know how Lego has flora and fauna kind of stuff, signage or things that they could plug in into this peg system so they could add things into their maze just for beautification if they wanted. But we also have ideas for specific games like soccer and things like that, where we might bring out little kits for other kinds of games that would go along. So the idea is that we could keep adding kits every 4 months or something for people to add on. And the toy itself is infinitely expandable, and kids really love that because it's a puzzle edge. They can just add kits on kits. So when we go, like we went to a girls in robotics program at St. Vrain, and we put two kits together for this great big huge thing, and they put together this big maze because they had bigger robots too. But yeah, we call it Kinesium in the gymnasium. Kinesium came from kinetics and gymnasium, and we kind of put those two words together.
Okay. Do you see a lot of interest from girls in robotics and product development?
I am happy that the schools are really trying to make sure that girls get exposed to these things, because I think I was very heavy in math and science growing up, and I probably should have gotten an engineering degree, but I didn't. I decided I wanted to go into art at that point in my life, so I went out and got a commercial art degree. But yeah, I mean, the girls had a great time at this girls in robotic program at St. Vrain. There were probably 50 girls there from third grade to seventh grade. They all had different levels of kits they were building, and they were programming them just a little bit to get them to run and starting to do autonomy. And there's another woman here in Colorado that started a robotics after school program called Kids to Glow. It's in Superior, same, equal, girls, boys in that. And I think it's helping girls to realize that they shouldn't shun math and science, right? It's not that they aren't good at it. They get trained early on to say math and science isn't for girls. And I think girls have done really well in the biologic sciences for years, but not as well in electronics and mechanical and programming. But I think that's going to change. Already has changed quite a bit.
You said you have some other ideas brewing, you know, queued up after Kinesium or any of those other toys, like TraxArt's next toy, or you're thinking beyond the toy world?
Both of them are also educational type toys, but I don't know if they'll be the right fit for TraxArt or not. We'll see. They wouldn't be defined as toys. Okay. They're educational products.
So you're a Boulder native, you mentioned as we were chatting before this interview. So you've seen a lot of changes here on the Front Range, and I wonder if you have any comments about or any views on the tech startup scene's development here and how it's impacted the Front Range and just how the community itself has evolved over time.
So I have to backpedal a little. I was born in Boulder Community Hospital, but my dad actually and mom decided not to buy the house on Mapleton Hill that they were looking at and bought a house in Broomfield. That's where I was actually raised. But
if they had bought the house on Mapleton Hill, maybe you wouldn't have to do the Kickstarter.
That's right, exactly. But yeah, I've been around Boulder and I've been really participating a lot in the tech scene recently. I think one thing is really interesting about the tech scene here that's different than other places. And I saw an interesting interview from a CEO that came from California and got placed into a startup here in Boulder. And she was a little dismayed. She's like, people want to go rock climb or they want to go ride their bike. And I'm like, yeah, people in Boulder don't want to give up their lifestyle, but they still want to be in tech. They don't want to work 70 hours. They don't want to drive 2-hour commutes to get to a job. They want to do it. They have the passion and they have the intellect. We have a really good university here. Turns out a lot of great people. But I think in tech in general in Boulder, we want to keep this wonderful lifestyle that we managed to have in Boulder because we have such a wonderful place that we live in. So I know that's probably not exactly what you were expecting to hear from me. But and then on the other side, I think I've found that this has been a really open and friendly and helpful community in tech. So I've been mentored by Innosphere Sage a little bit through along. I'm also a mentor to other people on the product side. I love going to 1 Million Cups and helping people think about their product differently maybe or other directions they might take a product. So I find people really generous here in really trying to help startup founders get off the ground. The money part, much harder. It's not like Silicon Valley where you can just put something on a piece of paper, walk up to somebody and they give you $10 million, which I think is a little outrageous anyway, because half the time you have to prove a little bit more than that. I think that trend is changing. People want a little bit more traction now before they give you money. But Silicon Valley has a reputation for people having an idea and getting a lot of money just for thinking up something and not really getting it any further than that.
So do you see Boulder as a very unique tech hub in relation to Austin or Silicon Valley or New York?
I probably don't have enough exposure to Austin and New York to really say, and really can only compare to what my experience with Silicon Valley. But so I don't know, but definitely people are flocking here, and that's a good and a bad thing for Boulder.
Right. I mean, you can't blame them. That's right. And the issues that come up around that, that's maybe another conversation. Yeah.
I do think women still struggle to fundraise no matter where they are.
So that's no different here than anywhere else.
I think so, yeah.
Do you feel like that's improving at all, or anything's changing around that?
I think there's a lot of good evidence that's coming out to have it move towards changing. I think women are slightly more conservative and frugal in a startup in the way they manage the money and the way they grow the company. And the evidence is that women started companies are more successful than male started companies and statistically, but women only get, I mean, something ridiculous, like 2% of the venture funding. And the stories still continue to come out about women who are trying to do venture funding and get sexually harassed in meetings and things like that. So it certainly still continues to be a topic of conversation about every time you walk into a venture meeting, you're walking into a room of generally Caucasian males that are over 50 or 60 years old. So that's the environment that you're raising funds in.
I guess the upside of that is that I'll be speaking with a lot of women for the tech podcast during Startup Week. And in past interviews, I've spoken with a lot of women, a lot of people working on diversity and expanding diversity in the tech field. But it just seems crazy that, I mean, because I've heard that statistic that women-owned companies far outperform male-owned companies. And so it seems kind of like
irony.
Irony, because everyone's so data-based, right, in their decision-making a lot of the time. Like, here's a very clear data point. So hopefully people will.
And we'll see. Venus Williams just started a venture company this week, so that was pretty awesome.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
What's it called?
I don't know, but she said she's focusing on women and people of minorities to raise money. So
excellent. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I appreciate this a lot, this interview, because it comes at such a great time with our Kickstarter launching on Friday. So
yeah, how can people find out more about that?
So you can go to our website now, traxarttoys.com. It's a palindrome, TRAXART.com. And that will lead you to a place where you can sign in to get on the notification list. But we can't announce the URL for the Kickstarter till we launch. So as soon as it launches, our URL will have a link to take you right to the Kickstarter page.
And you'll be able to find that at traxarttoys.com, and that's T-R-A-X, Trax.
A-R-T, yeah.
Yes.
You see, I got the art in there.
Yep.
Trax Art.
I love it. Susan Krause, Trax Art Toys, thank you very much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
That was Susan Krause, founder of Trax Art Toys. Learn more at traxarttoys.com. That's T-R-A-X-A-R-T. Follow Susan on Twitter at CEO Trax Art Toys. Episode number 39 of the Boulder Tech Podcast is presented by Boulder Startup Week product management track sponsor, Sovereign. The Boulder Tech Podcast is made possible in part by Boulder Startup Week platinum sponsors Honey, Matter, and Zayo. We're also supported by Glider, a Colorado-based community movement and nonprofit that produces Boulder's Ignite and TEDx events, as well as Boulder Startup Week. Learn more and consider a donation at glider.com. Thanks to Dojo 4 for providing space for our podcast studio, and to KGNU Community Radio for recording gear and studio usage. Our intro music is by Echo Deck. Hear more at echodeck.com. That's E-C-C-O-D-E-K. Our outro music is by Earthrise Sound System. You'll find them at earthrisesoundsystem.com. The Boulder Tech Podcast is produced by me, Joel Davis. Your feedback, criticisms, and comments are welcome. Reach me at joel@dojo4.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here for the next episode of the Boulder Tech Podcast.